Welcome to Access Utah. This is Addison Pace. Drug addiction is an epidemic in the United States. September is National Recovery Month, and it is also Pain Awareness Month. Treatment for chronic pain can sometimes lead to addiction. Dr. Lynn Webster specializes in addiction and pain medication. He talks to producer Sherry Quinn about the challenges of treating addiction and current methods that are most successful according to his experience with the growing problem. And his method might surprise you. It's very simple. The Hunt for Wolves will open next week in Wyoming. At 9:30, in part 2 of Science Questions series on wolves, Science Questions profiles the wolf with Utah State University wildlife ecologist Dan McNulty. He discusses wolf hunting behavior, rancher conflicts, and the implications of killing wolves.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. September is Pain Awareness Month, and as it turns out, it is also National Recovery Month. Pain Awareness Month is an effort to create a movement to improve pain care in America. Recovery Month is an effort to educate Americans on addiction treatment and mental health services that help individuals with mental or substance abuse disorders live long, healthy lives. Dr. Lynn Webster, Director of LifeTree Clinical Research in Salt Lake City, specializes in addiction and pain medicine. He joins us today to talk about the disease of addiction and the treatment challenges.
From my perspective of being a physician treating people with chronic pain as well as substance abuse, and the paucity of knowledge that we really have had in the field of the interface between both disorders, you know, chronic pain, which is a disease, and addiction, which is a disease. For years, I think we practiced and lived with very little knowledge and understanding of the magnitudes of the problems and how they interacted with each other and actually contributed to each other's disorders and diseases. We used to think that all pain could be essentially eliminated, either with an intervention or with pain medications. But I've certainly realized in the last few years, in the last 5 years, that that's not possible with a lot of people. This is a big area. There's no area in medicine that is, I think, more challenging than to treat people with moderate to severe chronic pain, and particularly with the tools that we have available. Unfortunately, the most powerful tools we have available are opioids, and that's where we both have an opportunity, but we also have great responsibility and get into a lot of trouble. You know, most people don't appreciate it, but genetically about one-fifth of the population is vulnerable to the disease of addiction. We don't know in individuals who undergo an operation or have a traumatic experience and are placed on an opioid what effect that opioid is going to have on them. Now, it may provide some pain relief, but it also may trigger a silent addiction, or at least the tendency to develop an addiction. So clinically, it's really difficult for physicians, particularly at the beginning, who are wanting to develop a good relationship with their patients, believing in their patients when they complain of pain, that we want to do the most for our patients, but at the same time, trying to judge them. That is an inherent conflict of our profession. To try to expect that physicians are going to be judging and be policing the behavior of our patients. You know, we try to do it in diabetes and say, you know, you've got to watch your calorie counts, you've got to watch your exercise, you've got to do these things and in order to minimize the impact of diabetes or heart disease. And this is true in pain, but when we give a prescription like an opioid to somebody who's in moderate to severe pain, they could be crying and screaming with pain, totally dysfunctional. It's entirely different than the silent hypertension that may kill, but the medicines we use for the treatment of hypertension or diabetes are entirely different than the opioids. So we see that there are some fundamental properties or characteristics of people in pain and addiction now that place them at higher risk. and that would be mental health disorders. One third, or actually about 25% of the population, have some type of an anxiety disorder. We have about the same number of people who have depression. All of these mental health disorders, these are just two examples, will contribute to the inappropriate use of opioids or other pain medicine, because often the pain medicine will not just treat the pain, but it'll also make them feel better with their mental health disorder. And our challenge as physicians who really want to help our patients is to try to figure out what is the drug being used the most for from time to time. And that's very difficult. And when we start a medicine like an opioid on somebody with chronic pain, it may be entirely different. That is, the way it's being used by that person may be entirely different than in 6 months or in a year or in 3 years after that point. So it's a very dynamic and moving target, which makes it very difficult.
A recovering addict who suffers from a severe injury from an event such as a car accident poses significant challenges for physicians. They still need to be treated for their pain, but it might ignite their desire to use again. In fact, it likely will cause them to abuse again.
And this is something we've learned a lot about in the last 10 years. These type of people deserve to have their pain treated. That's without a doubt. But how we treat them and with what kind of medications and how we monitor them are entirely different today than how we would have done it 5 years ago, or certainly 10 or 15 years ago. We understand that there are people who are at risk. And so maybe the type of medicines that we're going to use will be different. Maybe it won't be an OxyContin. Maybe it won't be something that's a rapid onset. Maybe it won't even be an opioid. Maybe we're going to try to find other ways that are non-interventional and non-pharmacologic to help with a lot of people. And certainly if an opioid needs to be used, there has to be more vigilance about when to discontinue the treatment, when to discontinue the opioid. And I think there has to be a fair amount of education with the patient as well, that they have some responsibility to understand that they can get themselves into trouble in this partnership that exists between a doctor and a patient. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't control how much food somebody eats when they leave our clinic if they're a diabetic. We can't control how many pills they'll take once they leave our clinic. And we need to have our patients be honest with us in order to appropriately prescribe and manage their pain. And so it is a partnership that has to be recognized by both sides, or disasters, tragedies will happen.
Right. I have been covering this issue for several years now, and as a result, I know several people who are drug addicts. And I hear about all what's happening out there in terms of drugs. And it just seems like it's a really difficult problem to solve, and really difficult to get people off of drugs who are serious addicts.
You know, addiction is a serious mental health disease. And by definition, it's a destructive disorder. And so once you have an addiction, whether it's alcohol, eating food, or opioids, it takes over. It is the loss of control. That's what the definition of addiction is. It's the loss of control. And so, yes, indeed. Oftentimes, in order for people who have one type of an addiction or the other, have to reach the bottom, or they die before there's a reversal. Now, we certainly want to prevent that from happening, and I think that we're beginning to appreciate that there is vulnerability with where it wasn't before. Long ago, we used to think that basically no one's who's experiencing pain is at risk of developing the disease of addiction. That's just not true. We know genetically that one-fifth of us are vulnerable, and if we're given the type of medicine that can develop into a dependence position and or stressors in our life that will make it more comfortable if we are using those medicines, that's how we get into trouble. In fact, let me tell you a story. I had just finished having a long conversation with a patient of mine who told me how she got into trouble with her prescriptions. started when she was in her teens or early 20s and had difficulty with an appendicitis and ovarian cysts, and so she would get pain medications. And then she got pregnant, and she lost her baby. And that was a very, very tragic event for her, very emotionally difficult. She had some difficulties with her environment at home, with her mom, who had just been divorced, and that her grandmother was ill, who happened to be her best friend, and was unable to speak with her as often. So the support structure that she had was dissipating, and she had pain. And what she found was that the use of the medicine to treat her pain was also allowing her to cope. And so she was using it now for the benefit of living her day-to-day activities and escaping. But unfortunately, because of the ease of access to get these medications through the people on the street or just calling up a doctor and say, I've got a bad migraine or I've got more cystic pain or pelvic pain, I need more medicine, the doctor believing her or the doctors believing her would give her enough medicine. And over a couple of year period, she began using them on a daily basis until she became physically dependent, basically, like a lot of people would say, she was addicted because she was using it for non-medical purposes. And if she tried to stop it, then she would go into withdrawal. And not until the day when she was so ill that she could not pick up her child at school in kindergarten did she realize that she had to get treatment. That was at the bottom for her, that she finally sought medical treatment, and she's doing beautifully now.
Are there certain drugs or medications that will help curb that addiction? Because it does seem to be such a biological issue.
Yes. We don't know about the disease process and the mechanisms well enough yet about the disease of addiction, regardless of the type of addiction. We know that basically there's a release of dopamine in the brain that causes people to feel good. And that's what sets you up for that disease of addiction. We're all made up differently, and we all have a different dump, let's say, of dopamine with various aspects of life, an alcohol, a drink, I should say, or a pill, or a potato chips. You know, they all can lead to a different amount of dopamine release. That much, though, we do know. We do know some of the mechanism involved, just not how to cure it. In fact, the National Institutes of Health have set as a goal that we find a cure, and this is with the director, Dr. Volkow, who's set as a mission here for us to find cures for addiction. And I think that is certainly something that we need to strive for. Meanwhile, what we're really trying to do is find ways to manage addictions. And cognitive therapy, but there are also some medications that can be used to help replace that dopamine dump and prevent withdrawals. Most of the people who are really in trouble and continue to crave are craving because their central nervous system has adjusted to the exposure of a drug, and they go through withdrawals if they don't have continued exposure. It is that withdrawal and the craving that drives continued use. So there are replacement medications, and if it's an opioid, it would be a methadone, which people hear about, methadone maintenance treatment, or buprenorphine, which is now commonly referred to as Suboxone. So those two opioids, they're both opioids, so they're still an opioid, can be used as a replacement under medical supervision and can provide, I think, a window for individuals to recover.
And how do those work? Because some of those addicts that I know, that's what they've used in transition to get when they get off drugs is methadone or Suboxone. And in some ways, they seem to be addicted to that too.
People who have the vulnerability for an addiction to one opioid will have a high risk of being addicted to all opioids. However, the pharmacology of methadone and buprenorphine allow them to be used in a way to help people regain a lot of the more of their functional activities and decrease their craving. It is a replacement. It's not a cure. And that's how we have to think about it. But it does help a lot of people move on in their life. And they can act and perform in normal ways as long as they continue with the medicine. Here's one of the issues, though. A very important point is that if you have a disease of addiction, and if it's the genetic kind that we usually, to some degree, we inherit, because it is genetic, then by being on replacement therapy for a short time is good, but it doesn't fix the genetics. And so for some people, they cannot be just placed into a detox program and expect to do well. That's the point. So people who have a disease of addiction to an opioid are going to struggle a great deal if they're admitted to a treatment center and given a 5-day, 7-day, 10-day detox program and then sent home, because they're going to still have cravings. And their central nervous system has not repaired. It can't repair that quickly, even if all they had was a physical dependence and they didn't have the natural craving for an opioid. People who have an opioid dependence or an addiction may need to be treated for years, many years. And I think it is dangerous for some people to think that they can just go in and be detoxed and then that they're healed, because the healing process takes much longer, and it may take years for many people. For some people, it's a lifelong issue.
Yeah.
I've had patients that are in their 60s and 70s for 40 years on methadone, and without it they probably wouldn't be alive today, but they've lived productive lives. And that doesn't mean that you're a skid row person. I mean, I'm talking about lawyers, doctors, politicians, so it can be anybody who's at risk.
There has been some progress, according to a national SAMHSA survey released this September. The number of people aged 18 to 25 who used prescription drugs for non-medical purposes in the past month declined 14%.
This is an excellent sign. There seems to be some results that we're seeing now from a lot of campaign work that and efforts that a lot of people, both in the government as well as outside the government, have put into curbing this problem. Unfortunately, though, the same report cited that an increase in the amount of heroin use. And to me, that's very significant, because what we don't want to do is squeeze the balloon, you know, meaning that if we improve one area of this grand, serious problem, we don't want to create a bigger problem somewhere else. What we really want to do is address all of the addiction problem and reduce heroin addiction as well as the prescription drug addiction. But it is a good sign, at least a subset of the overall addiction to opioid world is improving.
What are your favorite methods for recovery, and start with youth?
Well, I'm working on a lot of fronts on trying to address this from a medical perspective, because as a physician, I can have probably as much influence on providing information to physicians as I can in any other segment of society. And so we have developed an 8-point plan, basically 8 principles that we think will have a major impact in reducing the overdose deaths and curbing the problem of addiction and abuse within the pain population.
Okay.
And so part of that's making sure that the physicians understand that there are people at high risk that we never thought of before, and how to identify those people who are at high risk. Now, separate from that, attempting to work with large chain pharmacy chains to provide information to the consumer, the person who is actually buying the pain medicines, about how to safely store and use, dispose the pain medications so that they're not harmed, but also that these medications aren't diverted to other people like our children. Because Certainly, a lot of the harm has been with the adolescents, anywhere from 10-year-olds on up, who have been able to find the unused medications in our medicine cabinets at home from grandma, from mom and dad, aunt and uncle, whatever. And they get started just by using one or two that are fun, they think. And then they use them more and more, particularly if they have that vulnerability, that genetic vulnerability, then they become dependent on them, then they can't stop, and then they become so expensive they can't find them, and so then they start using heroin and other substances to get to that normal state, that normal psychological state. So one prevention of drugs to be available, that is, we want to prevent diversion, so that there's less available. Access is just more difficult for the illicit use. And then where children, or I call them children, young adults get into trouble, we need to have a place for them to go. Once they've gone into recovery, and in high schools across the country, or in, I should say in communities across the country, there are high schools that are being set up that understand that this is a problem and know how to treat the kids that have gotten into trouble. And these are what we call recovery schools. There are a few. They're struggling because of the finances and the economics and across the country. It's hard to get financial support from a government or from a state, but they have made some progress in certain areas of the country.
Any in Utah that you know about?
Not that I know of in Utah. I mean, there are certainly recovery schools. There are recovery schools where kids can go to be treated for their addiction, their dependence on medications, as well as be housed. So they're really not outpatient, but they're inpatient kind of facilities. But the kind of school I'm referring to is something that would be community supported, with people who don't need necessarily to be housed and incarcerated, if you will, but to be a part of the community and yet have the mental support, that is, the healthcare support that has mental health component to it, that'll help them get through a difficult time in their life, which is adolescence.
Dr. Lynn Webster says listening is the most successful form of treatment he has encountered over the span of his long career.
One of the things I've learned in some 25 years of practice is the most therapeutic thing I can do is to listen to my patient, allow them some time to talk, to express their frustrations, the stressors in their life, the anxiety that's causing their pain to go up, maybe to drive them to use a drug to find that escape. If that individual who has pain can find that individual within a family or outside the family, that'll probably provide them as much benefit as any medicine that we can provide. Curing is giving a pill and saying you're better. Healing is allowing them to tell you their story and acknowledging their story. There's a big difference.
For more information about Dr. Webster's work and prescription drug addiction, visit yourlifesource.org. That's yourlifesource.org. Sherry Quinn, Access Utah. Stay tuned for Science Questions up next. Producer Elaine Taylor profiles the mighty wolf.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan, now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Support for Science Questions comes from the College of Science at Utah State University, where graduates' acceptance rates to medical, dental, and graduate schools exceed national averages. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Science Questions. This is Elaine Taylor.
And this is Clint Holgate.
Wolves are once commonly found throughout North America. And although there is no official estimate of how many were on the continent prior to European settlement, some research suggests that the population was between 250,000 and 2 million. Hunting of wolves picked up in the 19th century as demand for their thick coats increased in Europe.
As settlement progressed, wolves were pushed farther and farther west. And as the number of buffalo dwindled, wolves turned their attention to new prey in the region, cattle and sheep. As ranching grew, so did the conflicts between the wolves and the ranchers.
To address the problem, the National Park Service created a predator control program in 1919, which encouraged the hunting of gray wolves on public land. By the 1930s, the wolf population in the western U.S. had crashed, and there were no longer packs in Yellowstone National Park.
It wasn't until the 1970s and the introduction of the Endangered Species Act that the U.S. government considered the reintroduction of wolves into the West. Reintroduction began in Yellowstone National Park in 1995, when 14 wolves were introduced from Canada. Over the next few years, 17 more wolves were added.
Since then, the gray wolf population has rebounded and spread out of the park into surrounding states. Today it has been delisted and is no longer protected by the Endangered Species Act in much of the West. It will soon be legal to hunt wolves in Wyoming. To learn more about these controversial canines, we spoke with an expert in the field.
My name is Dan McNulty. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Wildland Resources at Utah State University.
I asked McNulty for some background information.
Most people tend to think of a wolf pack as sort of a random collection of individuals, kind of like a street gang. But they're not. They're a family. And the center of that family are the parents, the breeding male and the breeding female. These two individuals are often referred to in the literature as the alpha male and alpha female. So, but the alpha male and alpha female are the parents, the daddy wolf and the mommy wolf, if you will. And then they have their offspring, and those offspring could be from multiple generations. So you'll have a pack that's comprised of the breeding pair, the male and the female, and then pups of the year, that'll make up the majority of the pack, and then you'll have yearlings from the year's prior pups, litter, and then maybe some two-year-olds and even some three-year-olds in there. So that is sort of the classic description of a wolf pack in terms of its composition.
In his recent research, which focused on wolves in Yellowstone, McNulty has looked at the optimal pack size for hunting.
4, on average, is the pack size at which a wolf pack will maximize their hunting success. And any additional increase in pack size beyond 4 doesn't lead to any further increase in hunting success.
We also asked him about how wolves take down such big prey.
Wolves are actually very limited in the sort of tools that they have at their disposal to take down a large prey. It really comes down to their teeth. They don't have retractable claws like a large cat would have. They don't have muscular forelimbs like a cat would have. So they're really limited in their ability to use their limbs to tackle an animal. So it really just comes down to biting an animal using their teeth.
Do wolves get hurt a lot in this process?
They do. Wolves are commonly injured by the prey that they take down. Even small prey like deer can actually injure wolves severely. I'll never forget when I was a field technician for a wolf study in northern Minnesota, we came across a wolf skull, and it had a perfectly ingrained cloven hoof print right between the eyes as if it was stamped by a deer's hoof. And so even a small prey like a deer could really punish a wolf, and never mind, you know, trying to take down a bison, because wolves are killed by a bison. They're routinely injured, stepped on, they're stabbed with the horns. Kicked. I mean, taking down a bison is a real boxing match for a wolf.
So why do wolf groups get so large then, if kind of the hunting levels off at four?
Well, it has a lot to do with resource availability. So in areas where prey are abundant, females will be more reproductively successful, have larger litter sizes, more pups surviving than in areas where there are few prey resources. And so most packs actually are comprised of pups of the year. And so if it's a good year in terms of prey availability, then that will translate into a large litter size and large litter survival, and that will have an immediate effect on pack size. So pack size is largely a function of resource availability, and resource availability is influenced also not only by just the number of prey that are in an area, but the number of wolf packs that are competing for that prey resource.
The wild wolves around in the morning, I'll call you.
McNulty also looked at how the pressures of climate change could possibly impact wolves and other animals in Yellowstone.
So we are generally interested in understanding what the effects of environmental change are on wildlife populations, okay? And we were using wolves as a model system to investigate this.
How do you figure that out?
So it was sort of an elaborate mathematical exercise.
Basically, McNulty and his colleagues ran a set of mathematical models which predicted how certain species would react to different environmental pressures. And since evolution takes more than a few generations and is influenced by many factors, his team was unable to demonstrate their predictions in the wild. However, their formula does allow them to scientifically predict what could happen to the wolf population.
So we developed a series of scenarios, if you will, to sort of examine what the hypothetical effects of environmental change could be on this population.
I don't know if you want to talk about this, but so if climate change continues and Yellowstone gets warmer, mm-hmm. what would you predict would happen to the wolves in that area?
A lot of it depends on what happens to the prey population. A lot of it depends on how warming influences disease prevalence. If disease, say for example, canine distemper virus, becomes more prevalent, or mange becomes more prevalent as a result of warming, then that will negatively affect the wolf population, because those diseases have a profound effect on wolf reproduction and survival.
To be with you is easy.
Since their reintroduction in 1995, conflicts between wolves and ranchers have reappeared.
Keep in mind that these conflicts are the original reason why wolves were forced out of the region to begin with. Unlike the past, researchers like Dan McNulty are applying what they have learned about wolf behavior to help manage conflicts when they arise.
However, some conflicts cannot be avoided.
There is no silver bullet in terms of allowing wolves to coexist with livestock. Typically, the only foolproof way of reducing conflict is to either eliminate the wolves or eliminate the livestock. Animals that are easy to kill are the smallest animals. They're the slowest animals. They are animals that are old, sick, etc. These animals are preferred because they can be killed by a wolf with little risk to the wolf itself. And so that rule of thumb that wolves use to kill wild prey, to kill without being killed, is the same rule of thumb they apply to domestic livestock. Managers and livestock operators can use that rule against wolves in managing their herds, then yes, there is an opportunity to reduce the likelihood that wolves will prey on your stock.
Wolves are much less likely to attack cattle than sheep because of their size and likelihood of becoming injured while hunting. McNulty suggests that raising cattle in areas known to have wolves can reduce the prey-predator conflict. He also suggests keeping more full-grown cattle in a herd when there are calves present, since wolves are more intimidated by larger animals. I guess I haven't read the numbers. How big of a problem is this really? Like, is it happening frequently throughout the West?
It is.
The frequency of conflict really depends on the proximity and the number of wolves and herds of livestock in an area.
As you range beyond that core area into areas that are more livestock use, then you start getting into areas of chronic conflict. And in these areas, having wolves is going to be a management challenge.
Why are wolves even important to an ecosystem? Why did we want them back in the first place, and what's their role now?
So the role of wolves in an ecosystem is one of top predator. Take Yellowstone, for example. After wolves were eliminated from Yellowstone by the 1930s, there was no other major predator of elk. And elk numbers grew quite rapidly. And I think by 1987 or so, shortly before the fires, there was something on the order of 22,000 elk on the northern range. And so that had repercussions in terms of the amount of space available for other ungulates, the effects of that number of animals on the habitat in terms of vegetation. And so now that wolves have been reintroduced and recovered in Yellowstone, they are slowing elk population growth. They have had a role in reducing elk numbers. And we think that that's having downstream effects on other organisms, plant and animal. The role of wolves in an ecosystem is by no means a open and shut case. In other words, this is an area of active research. We are very interested in understanding precisely the effects wolves have on prey populations in Yellowstone and elsewhere. And the extent to which they can limit a prey population oftentimes is context-specific.
By context-specific, McNulty means that wolves can help keep prey populations in check. But the most important check on populations is the environment. As much as hunting can reduce a population size, for better or for worse, the availability of food and the harshness of weather will have a far bigger impact on a herd's ability to survive.
At the end of the day, my feeling is that the presence and absence of wolves in any given area is really a function of whether or not the people that live in that area value wolves. For whatever reason, whether they value them aesthetically or they value them for ecological reasons. And so whether wolves are in areas outside of places like Yellowstone, outside protected areas, will really be contingent on the attitudes of the local human population. You know, since the 80s, the emphasis has been on encouraging wolf population growth and encouraging the increase in wolf numbers. So it's been a problem of scarcity with wolves. Now that the wolf has been delisted in Idaho and Montana, and at the end of the month in Wyoming, so all three states will have management responsibility over their wolf populations, the problem now isn't one of wolf scarcity so much as it is one of perhaps wolf abundance. There are areas where there is chronic conflict, and so there's a legitimate desire to reduce wolf numbers in those areas.
Due to a marked increase in population size, Wyoming will legalize the hunting of wolves starting next week.
I asked McNulty how he felt about the hunting of wolves.
Oh, I think legal harvest of wolves is a legitimate use of wolves. I don't see any problem with that. I get the impression that some people want to see wolves everywhere, and yet also keep in mind that there's another large group of people that don't want to see they don't want to see wolves anywhere. So you've kind of got those two ends of the spectrum, and I think the middle ground is in recognizing that we have space for wolves in some places, but we also have spaces where we're not going to have any wolves. And I think people need to become comfortable with that. I think I think when you talk about balance in terms of management and conservation of wolves, I think that's the recognition that is where we need to go, is perhaps not shared universally in the broader community and society. But I think that's where people need to train their focus in terms of where we need to go and how we need to be thinking about wolves in the Western United States.
So what about Utah?
There's no wolf population in Utah.
Currently, the northern half of Utah is under state control because that's where wolves have been delisted.
However, farther south, the federal government has management authority since the wolves in that area are still considered endangered. This arbitrary line has created confusion about how to treat wolves that end up in the state.
This may not be as big of a problem as it would be in other western states because, as McNulty points out, Utah does not provide an optimal environment for wolves to live in.
Wolves require large tracts of land and large elk or deer populations. And although Utah has unpopulated areas or areas with prey, they typically do not overlap in a way that would support a wolf pack.
For the states that do have populations of wolves, McNulty is ultimately positive about the reintroduction efforts, so long as we can find the right management plan.
The good news is that wolves are biologically resilient, and they have a tremendous capacity to sustain their numbers through high survival and high reproduction. So biologically, they are not a difficult species to manage. And so that's good news in terms of maintaining these sustainable populations.
And then I guess with the continued growth of human populations and development and increasing number of livestock that are being raised, do you think that this repopulation effort can be successful? Do you think we can find some kind of an equilibrium?
Certainly. And I would say that right now we collectively, you know, society in the Western United States is trying to find where that balance is.
Next week, the hunting of wolves in Wyoming will begin. Over 800 tags have already been sold.
And this decision is sure to shape the future of the gray wolf. It was less than 100 years ago that the wolf was hunted out of existence in this region. And although the conflicts that pushed the wolf out of the West the first time are the same as the conflicts that are happening now, we here at SQ Radio hope the population can be managed more thoughtfully this time around. For Science Questions, I'm Elaine Taylor.
And I'm Clint Holgate.
Hunt a wolf! They'll take a double-edged blade, and they'll put blood on the blade, and they'll melt the ice and stick the handle in the ice so that only the blade is protruding, and that a wolf will smell the blood and wants to eat, and it'll come and lick the blade trying to eat. And what happens is when the wolf licks the blade, of course, he cuts his tongue and he bleeds, and he thinks he's really having a good thing. He drinks and he licks, and of course he's drinking his own blood, and he kills himself. That's what the imperialists did to us with crack cocaine. You got these young brothers out there thinking that they're getting something that they're going to make a living with. They're getting something they can buy a car like the white people have cars. Why can't I have a car? They're getting something that they can get a piece of gold. The white people have gold. Why can't I have gold? They're getting something to get a house. The white people have a house. Why can't I have a house? And they actually think that it's something that's bringing resources to them, but they're killing themselves just like the wolf who's licking the blade, and they're slowly dying without knowing. That's what's happening to the community. You with me on that? That's exactly and precisely what happens to the community. And instead of blaming the hunter who put the damn handle and the blade in the ice for the wolf, that what happens is the wolf gets blamed for trying to live. That's what happens in our community. You don't blame the person, the victim, you blame the oppressor. Imperialism, white power is the enemy. Was the enemy when it first came to Africa, snatched up the first African, brought us here against our will, is the enemy today.
Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Susie Montgomery, and Elaine Taylor, with production support by Clint Holgate and music selections by Tohar Gopher. Thank you for listening.
Reincarnation is the belief that after you die, your soul will be reborn in a different body or form. It's often thought of in spiritual terms. But science has its own version. It's called nutrient cycling. In the final part of our series, More Than a Tree, KUOW's Sarah Waller visits a cemetery to explore how our bodies can take on new life in the form of a tree.
I'm here at the Meadow Cemetery in Ferndale, Washington. It looks like a meadow, full of tall grass and purple clover. There are no headstones, at least not visible ones. You'd never guess people are buried here, but they are. And that means under the ground, a form of reincarnation is taking place.
There is so much meaning in putting new life on the ground above a loved one, knowing that in a very real and literal way, that person is going to nurture that tree and their molecules are going to become part of it.
Brian Flowers oversees burials at the Meadows. It's not a conventional cemetery. When you bury your loved one here, you're handed a shovel and a tree seedling. No embalming fluids or synthetic coffins are allowed. The idea is to let the body return as naturally as possible to the earth.
Here's my mother's gravesite. There was nothing that she wanted more when she died than to be returned to the soil.
Trisha Otto buried her mother here 2 summers ago. It was a place they chose together while her mother Lori was still alive. Her mom was a well-known environmental activist and pioneer in the natural landscape movement, which favored the use of wild grasses and native plantings over fertilized, manicured lawns. So the Meadows felt like home.
Actually, there was a large anthill right on her site, and she was thrilled about that. Maybe her only worry was that it might have to be destroyed when it was her time.
Trisha and her mom liked coming here together. Her mom would sit in a folding chair perched right at the edge of her future grave, while Trisha pulled weeds and tended the soil. They talked about life, and they planted a tree.
Mother chose an oak tree, and so we planted that about a year before she died.
When Trisha's mom passed away, her body was wrapped in a white cloth and lowered into the grave. Her friends and family took up shovels. By hand, they covered her with soil. That's when a transformation started taking place.
There was always a reshuffling. There was always a recycling. There was always sort of a reincarnation of everything.
Nalini Nadkarni is a scientist who knows a lot about something called nutrient cycling. It's the way nutrients move from one body to the next. For example, it's the way that a tiny piece of Trisha's mom might end up in a tree leaf. To follow the process, we can look at one particular part of her body.
Like, say, a piece of hair.
And in that hair, there's a particle of nitrogen, for example. At first, the hair gets chewed up by insects in the soil. It's still hair, just smaller. But then, it gets consumed by bacteria and fungi. They digest it, and that nitrogen gets clipped off and reshuffled into a different molecule.
And that becomes available for, say, a tree root to absorb and start moving that through the tree to be turned into a leaf or a piece of bark or a piece of wood.
So the very particle of nitrogen that had been in Trisha's mother's hair might show up in a leaf on the oak tree that is growing on her mother's grave. Or rather, the tree that was growing on her mother's grave.
When I came out to look at it a month or so ago, by golly, it had been clipped off at the base by a rabbit. Mother loved rabbits, so we're replanting it this fall.
That, I think, is the key point, that when someone is buried, the nitrogen and the other molecules can actually move through not only a single ecosystem, but it can move through time unchanged.
This process has been going on for centuries, for millennia. It's the way that the stuff of our being, the very stuff we're made of, gets circulated all over the world, place to place, organism to organism. And that means that the very same nitrogen that went from Trisha's mom to a tree to a rabbit
could have been a nitrogen molecule that was originally in the bagel that Napoleon ate on his march to Russia. And it doesn't stop there. It goes back in time because that nitrogen might have been actually the back hair of a woolly mammoth thousands of years ago. Because of this idea of recycling, that matter is neither created nor destroyed, but rather recycled over and over again and reborn into some other living entity. And that, to me, is kind of a miracle.
Trisha wants to be buried next to her mother. She stands at her gravesite and pushes back the tall grasses and points to a river stone bearing her name. Next to it, Trisha has already planted a tiny oak tree, just like the one by her mother's grave, before the rabbit ate it.
This tree is part of the earth, and I'm going to be part of the earth. I am part of the earth right now. My molecules are just going to be recycled into all of this around me. It feels wonderful.
I'm Sarah Waller.
Dr. Nalini Nadkarni was the scientific advisor for our series, More Than a Tree. Jim Gates was the editor. Funding for our series was provided by the KUOW Program Venture Fund. Contributors include Paul and Loria Hearn, KUOW's Board of Directors, and listener subscribers. Additional support was provided by the National Science Foundation. To hear the entire series, or to learn more about the Program Venture Fund, go to KUOW.org.
Regional correspondents on Utah Public Radio provide that unique link that makes UPR's statewide news coverage your favorite resource for news. Hi, I'm Mackenzie Hamilton. Join me each evening during All Things Considered at 5:30 for expanded Utah news. UPR has a one-of-a-kind network with reporters from Southern Utah, the Uinta Basin, Moab, and Utah County. It's the only way of providing you with the views and news that you need to make informed decisions. Utah Public Radio, your favorite public radio station for statewide Utah news.
At Utah Public Radio, we discuss current events, social issues, gardening tips, politics, talk with local authors, and many other important Utah-related subjects. On Access Utah, an original program produced by Utah Public Radio. I'm Addison Pace, production intern for Access Utah. Join us weekday mornings 9 to 10, Utah Public Radio, Utah's favorite public radio station, for providing your access to things that matter in Utah.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.